Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Felt like debate week this week, didn't it? Biden versus Ryan, Bielut versus Kennedy, and Brown versus Warren, who sharpened their messages and their differences in their third debate.
He's had exactly one chance to vote for equal pay for equal work, and he voted no.
When you're talking about getting hammered, Professor Warren, I suggest you put down the hammer because it's your regulations and your policies that are going to be hurting.
Three debates down, one to go. Also this week, big questions about what went wrong at the Framingham Compounding Pharmacy, where contaminated drugs caused an outbreak of fungal meningitis that has left 170 people sick and 14 dead.
Did the regulations fail? Did the pharmacy fail? Did personnel fail? Were the regulations there and they weren't followed correctly?
Also this week, in the ongoing state crime lab scandal, more defendants petition for release due to those alleged mishandling of drug evidence. And Boston Mayor Tom Menino says that could lead to a new crime wave in the streets of Boston.
This is an emergency situation for our neighborhoods. We just treat it that way.
From politics to pharmacy oversight to more fallout from the state crime lab scandal, there's plenty to talk about with our Week in Review panel.
And joining us now to do just that are Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. Dante, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in the studio today is John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and creator of the blogs CampaignOutsider.com and It's Good to Live in a TwoDailyTown.com. Hey there, John.
Good to be here.
So let's start today right with the local compounding pharmacy, the Framingham-based one, the New England Compounding Center, in which the steroids delivered from that center are believed to be responsible for a national outbreak of fungal meningitis that's left at least 170 people sick and 14 dead at last count. Now, the NECC is said to have shipped vials of those contaminated steroids to over 75 healthcare facilities in 23 states. And the number of people believed to be exposed to that drug may have grown up to 14,000. And questions continue about the pharmacy's regulation procedures and the fact that if it had inadequate regulatory oversight.
Did the regulations fail? Did the pharmacy fail? Did personnel fail? Were the regulations there and they weren't followed correctly?
Those are all good questions coming from Derek Anderson, the owner of a mom and pop pharmacy, the J.E. Pierce Apothecary in Brookline. Dante, let's start with you. What's your take on this ongoing healthcare calamity?
Well, it's funny. We're talking about a strange little corner of the pharmacy industry here, the compounding pharmacies, which, you know, they exist to prepare forms of drugs for people who, you know, can't take a pill or the form that they normally come in. And, you know, the rest of the pharmacy industry has undergone a lot of consolidation over the last couple of decades, but you know, it seems as though, at least from a report that you had on your station and that I've seen elsewhere, that compounding has become a sort of niche market for smaller, more independent companies. And, you know, to some degree, it seems like they're satisfying niches that large drug makers don't. It also seems the state is saying that at least New England Compounding Center has exceeded their what they were allowed to do under the licensing rules. You know, to put it in a more neutral way, it looks as though they may have seen a business niche somewhere between a small pharmacy and a larger drug maker, and, you know, maybe there wasn't a whole lot of regulation where they ended up.
Well, in fact, when we spoke with the former counsel for the FDA, that's exactly what he said, and that there are many such compounding pharmacies that are just right in that size where they're too big for the state to regulate, but the FDA, especially after 2002, has really taken a hands-off approach. I mean, it is something of a black hole, isn't it, John?
Right. It reminds me of condo insurance. You know, you take your homeowner's insurance and your association insurance, and each one of them says, it's not my job to pay off that that damage. And that's the way it is. I mean, there is no one really who is going to step up. The state pharmacy boards say, we don't have the capacity to do this. We're not able to actually go out and inspect and regulate. And the FDA says, we don't have the authorization to go in and do that. So these kinds of situations happen.
And, I mean, we were hearing that also this week there may be a push for criminal charges to be brought. And there was an excellent report on NPR of people asking, well, if they're shipping to multiple states across the country, how can we expect, folks in Tennessee to regulate what's coming out of Massachusetts? Which is why Congressman Ed Markey made this comment earlier this week.
There is a regulatory black hole. I think we have to ban those types of pharmacies from compounding drugs using ingredients that are not approved by the FDA.
So, Dante, that seems to me to be rather strict, an outright ban, because while this regulatory black hole exists, as you were saying, this is a pretty big niche market if we're having tens of thousands of people relying on steroids coming from one pharmacy.
Oh, most definitely. On the other hand, probably if there's legislation that gets passed, it might not go as far as what Congressman Markey wants it to go. But, it seems like the inevitable result of this. This is a big, big scandal. And people were sickened and died on a scale that most of us probably wouldn't have thought possible from the part of an industry that we probably hadn't paid much attention to. So I think it's almost inevitable that there's going to be some kind of national regulation on this.
John, you're
thought on that? The legal ramifications are going to occur on a number of different platforms. One of them is a woman filed the first federal lawsuit today, a Minnesota woman filed the first federal lawsuit against New England Compounding Center. Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal has called on the Department of Justice to launch a criminal investigation. And I think that the civil lawsuits are going to be legion, but I think there's going to be very possibly criminal prosecution as well. Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley has said it's too soon to be talking about any kind of legal action, but I think it's inevitable that it's going to happen on a number of different areas.
Well, let's move on to some of the political news this week. In the race for the U.S. Senate, incumbent Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren debated for the third time in Springfield this time. They focused on jobs, the national debt, military spending, and issues important to women. Here's Warren going after Brown's voting record.
He had exactly one chance to vote for insurance coverage for birth control and other preventive services for women. He voted no. And he had exactly one chance to vote for a pro-choice woman from Massachusetts to the United States Supreme Court, and he voted no.
And here's Scott Brown going after Elizabeth Warren's repeated claim that the middle class has been hammered.
When you're talking about getting hammered, Professor Warren, I suggest you put down the hammer because it's your regulations and your policies that are going to be hurting.
We'll give you a couple extra seconds.
Thank you.
Please.
Your policies and that are going to be hurting middle class families and every class of family in Massachusetts and the United States.
So no mention of Warren's Native American ancestry all evening, a real focus on the issues. Pretty tough performance by both of them, I thought. Let me start with you, Dante. Your thoughts about Wednesday night's debate?
Well, I thought certainly both candidates gave a pretty crisp rendition of the lines that we've been hearing in debates. But it does feel as though this race has reached a fairly mature state in the sense that, we know the lines. You can almost rattle them off on cue. Second most bipartisan senator, check. Millionaires and billionaires, check. I feel like you watch a couple of these debates and you can almost recite the lines. One other thing that I noticed during the race or during the debate the other night was it did seem to me a little bit that Brown did kind of sharpen his at least his mentioning of some local roots, some things reflecting his local roots, Wakefield High, Friendly's the Big E. I don't think there's a whole lot of local issues in this race, but he does seem to be at least reminding people that he's the one from Massachusetts.
John Carroll, what's your take? The polls show that this race remains close, but as Dante said, we've had three debates. We're going to have a fourth debate. Can a fourth debate actually move this race one way or another? Or are we sort of locked in spite of what goes on? on in these debates?
It's hard to know. A lot of people look to debates and say this can be a really significant factor in how people vote. I don't get the feeling that these three debates so far have been a significant factor. I think the biggest impact of this Springfield debate was the lunch money that Scott Brown spread around all over the western part of the state. I mean, he had lunch in about seven different places, I think, as far as I could tell. So, and I think that basically this has gotten to be a sort of defensive kind of situation, to go in and not lose. I think that they see big risks, both of them see big risks in being too aggressive. Scott Brown has dialed it way back from the first debate when he was really hot. And I think that essentially they're looking to do no harm at this point and leave the rest of the work up to the advertising.
And speaking of that, John, I wanted to ask you about that as our advertising maven. Lots of money in both of the candidates' coffers. I expect we're going to be seeing a lot more on the airwaves. In terms of that, what's been working for them? What hasn't been working for them? What are we going to see?
I'm not sure what's been working for them. I think what they're going to be doing going forward is going to happen on parallel lines. I think both of them are going to have testimonials. Scott Brown right now has a testimonial out there from the daughter of one of the asbestos victims who Elizabeth Warren worked against, supposedly, on behalf of Travelers Insurance. And it's a very affecting story, and those kinds of ads work. Those human interest ads work. I think Elizabeth Warren will come back with some testimonials of her own, but I think that she's going to be going after policy issues. Mm-hmm. So that whole, he had one chance to do this, he had one chance to do that, that whole riff that she did in the debate, that's her latest ad. So I think that she's going to be going after him on a policy basis to try to get that sort of ideological edge. He's going to go after her on character and track record in terms of her legal career.
Well, let's move on to the race for the 6th Congressional District, which has become really sort of nasty and personal. This one pits incumbent John Tierney against former Republican State Senator Richard Tesei. This week, Tierney released an ad that addresses head-on questions about what he might have known about an illegal offshore gambling ring run by his brothers-in-law.
My opponent, Richard Tesei, has talked a lot about my wife, Patrice, and the mess her brothers have gotten into. The judge said I wasn't involved in any way, shape, or form, and he was right. But Richard Tesei, he'll do anything to try to distract you.
So now Richard Tesei's campaign has demanded that he take that ad down, claiming that it distorts what the judge actually said when he sentenced Tierney's wife, Patrice, to prison last year. Dante, according to your paper, U.S. District Judge William Young did say that Tierney was, quote, not implicated in this in any way, shape, or form. What do you make of this very ugly race for the 6th?
Well, it seems as though, at least in the context of the ad, you know, as you said, the quote from the ad, from Tierney reflects what tracks pretty closely what the judge said, more so than a lot of things in politics do. So, you know, it's probably the best that Tierney can do in this situation. You really don't want to be in a position in the middle of October where you're cutting ads saying that you weren't, you know, that the judge says you weren't aware of your wife's misconduct. Mm-hmm. It's not a great situation to be in, but you know, this is the classic kind of race that turns into an ugly slugfest where there's a, you know, an incumbent who has some trouble and there's a strong challenger.
Yeah, John Carroll, your take on the Tierney to say race at this point.
I love the line in the hotline when they were reporting on the debate, and they said to say and Tierney ripped into each other for the harsh tenor of the campaign. I mean, that's a great way to elevate the tone, right? So I think that Tierney has a sort of a problem here. He's bringing up his wife's situation as much as to say
it. I found it really interesting that he did that he felt he had to do that.
He's done it in this ad. He did it preemptively at the debate. He was the one who raised the issue, and to say sort of backed off from it. He didn't really go after it very hard. So I'm not sure if he thinks that his ads are doing the work and he doesn't want to be the person to sort of compound the message, that just let the ads do the work. I think that's probably a smart strategy, if that's his strategy.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he's taking an opposite take of the old adage of the best, best defense is a good offense?
Or the best offense is a good defense. It plays both ways.
One or the other. Well, finally, let's move on to the ongoing fallout from the so-called rogue chemist Annie Dukin, who once worked at the state drug lab and whose mishandling of evidence could have an impact on more than 34,000 drug cases in the Commonwealth. And there was a significant development in one of those cases just this afternoon. It's the case of Sean Drumgold. And in the past, he was wrongfully convicted of the murder of a 12-year-old girl. But he was back in court this week for selling cocaine and heroin. Dukin's initials appeared on some evidentiary paperwork in Drumgold's case. And today, a judge found Drumgold not guilty. Here's his attorney, Rosemary Scapiccio.
Based on the testimony that came out here in this trial, I would suggest that any evidence that touched that lab during the time period that Ms. Dugan was involved should be thrown out. Any evidence that touched that lab.
Dante, let's start with you. I mean, I don't necessarily hear any law enforcement officials calling for that, but is that the direction we're going to head? Like, all this evidence being just automatically thrown out?
Well, I don't know about automatically thrown out, but I think it does throw into question almost everything that she touched, or maybe everything that she touched at the crime lab, and it turns out that that was a lot of things. One of the problems at the crime lab is that it seems to have been underfunded and understaffed in certain ways. And so, you know, it was an environment where if you have one chemist who's just pushing through an unhumanly large number of tests, she starts to be seen as a star and an inspiration to other people until it becomes clear that, you know, the tests are problematic. But it's really hard to overstate how much of a catastrophe this whole episode is for the criminal justice system in the state.
John?
Yeah, except but I don't think this is the one that's going to set the standard, because according to the Globe report, anyway, the judge did not cite the drug lab results or testimony when he issued his judgment. He basically cited the fact that the law enforcement officials could not prove, and the prosecution couldn't prove, that the drugs belonged to Sean Drumgold just because he was in the same room. So I think this is going to be a major issue, and it's going to be the family-sized can of worms going forward. But I don't think this is the one that that kicks it off.
Well, a new wrinkle also this week in this case, not the Drumgold case, but the overall drug lab story, is that U.S. District Court Judge Mark Wolf said several hundred federal-level cases could be affected by this. And at the same time, Boston Mayor Tom Menino held a meeting today to basically help the city plan for the possibility that hundreds or thousands of people currently in prison could soon be back on city streets. Here's the mayor.
This is an emergency situation for our neighborhoods. We just treat it that way.
Dante, I've read that the effort to increase law enforcement to cope with this huge number of people could cost, you know, $3.5 million, and that Boston's asking for funds from the federal government. What's your take on the impact on day-to-day life in Boston?
You know, we when large numbers of people who are guilty of criminal offenses end up being, you know, being taken out of the community or put into the community, you know, people in law enforcement say that that has a huge effect on, you know, on the rates of crime and things like that. I mean, I guess the question is, were there a lot of cases here where somebody was wrongfully convicted because of tampered evidence that's been tampered with? You know, I guess if you presume that, you know, that a lot of the people were guilty and that the problems with the evidence tend to be more of a technical nature, then sure, it ends up being a lot more criminals being put back on the street. But, I mean, I think we should be aware of the possibility that people were wrongly convicted. That's why we're having this discussion.
Exactly. And in fact, the ACLU also makes that point explicitly, saying that, you know, this calls into question the whole manner in which drug cases are tried, and the fact that there are lots of mandatory minimums also that apply to many people who are in the criminal justice system. John, your thoughts on that?
And this could just be the first wave of the ones who are coming out, because the ACLU and the group Families Against Mandatory Minimums is appealing to the courts to release all the minor drug charges, the thousands of the cases that were minor drug cases, and all the major ones where the convicted has served half his prison time or her prison time. So, I mean, this could be a sort of a successive series of waves of people coming out of prison and not really being able to, not having the resources to reintroduce themselves to the community or resume their life in the community.
Yeah. Well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs. And Anthony, you want to start with yours?
Sure. You know, my hubbub is about baseball, of course. And Red Sox fans, I know it was a terrible year. Most of us think we don't have a dog in the current offseason fight. But there's a local boy worth rooting for. Jason Hamill, who makes his home in Rehoboth, Massachusetts, will be pitching the biggest game of his major league career tonight, this afternoon, actually, 5 p.m. in Yankee Stadium. He'll be on the mound for the Baltimore Orioles, taking on C.C. Sabathia of the Yankees. If the Orioles win, they move on to the ALCS. If the Yankees lose, They go home, which will provide a little solace for the Red Sox, so Red Sox fans. So go O's, and let's hear it for Jason Hamill of Rehoboth.
Wait a minute. As a made Yankee fan in Boston, check my Facebook group, by the way. Are those the only two choices, the Orioles win or the Yankees lose? I mean, what about
today,
the prospect
I'm
that the
Yankees
could win?
Today, I'm afraid those are the choices,
all right,
okay?
All right,
you'll
fine,
just have to
fine.
Deal
it's your show.
John, as a gesture of reconciliation, what's your hubbub?
You can root for Detroit. That's okay, too.
Thanks a lot. My hubbub is, despite the vaunted People's Pledge between Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown, but not in violation of it, three outside groups have actually, over the past 3 weeks, spent about $1 million in robocalls, direct mail, and door-to-door canvassing. The groups are the League of Conservation Voters, which is a liberal group, Americans for Tax Reform, which is Grover Norquist's flat tax group, and Crossroads GPS, which is run by the former House of Bush consigliere Karl Rove. They are going to spend a lot more money, too. This doesn't violate the pledge because the pledge is about television ads, radio ads, and internet ads. But there are some people who are saying, you know, this is really unfortunate that they are coming and inserting themselves into a race that has basically been a race between just two candidates. Refreshing and unique, really, across the country.
Those robocalls, though, are the reason why my daughter keeps pointing the phone and saying, Mama, it's that person calling again.
Yeah. Well, tell her they'll stop soon.
Dante, what's your hubbub?
Well, there was a sad story this week about a dead finback whale that was floating around in Boston Harbor. And earlier this week, it came to rest on an uninhabited harbor island. A city official told me earlier today that it came to rest last night on a different harbor island. There's a lot riding on this because, according to a Globe story earlier this week, if a dead whale washes up on your property, you are stuck with the tab under federal law. And that runs from $15,000 to $20,000. So it's not clear at this point whether the city or the state or somebody else will be on the hook for that. But it's also not clear who actually does this work because there's no category on Craigslist for whale carcass removal.
Oh, there may be now in the next 2 minutes.
Makes life in Worcester look pretty good, huh?
Well, no, I'm not. I don't mean to laugh about the dead whale, because that is
May actually, he rest in peace.
Yes, that is quite sad. But my hubbub actually has to do with what has to be one of the coolest businesses in Massachusetts. I've got to make a field trip to the David Clark Company because apparently this is the company that created the spacesuit used on the first U.S. spacewalk. And they're designing the suit for Felix Baumgartner, who sometime in the next few days is going to take a balloon 120,000 feet to the edge of space, open his capsule door, and jump out. And he will be a human bullet. He will possibly break the sound barrier. And he's putting his life in the hands of the David Clark Company of Worcester, who are making his suit. Amazing.
I love that story.
You're just going to look at the suit, right? You're not going to like wear it and jump out of something.
No, I'll leave that to Anthony, who has done some skydiving.
No, I'm going to get that suit and wear it this winter just to stay warm.
Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. Always great to have you.
Thank you.
And John Carroll, Communications Professor at Boston University and blogger at campaignoutsider.com. And it's good to live in a todailytown.com. Great to see you as well.
Likewise. Thanks.
Stay with us. Up next, love, relationships, and complications in the era of Facebook. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.